Hi, I'm Rob Cottingham from Social Signal, and this is episode 3 of the Social Speech Podcast. This is where we look at how the newest communication technologies are transforming the oldest, public speaking. Over the next few weeks, I'm talking with some of the smartest public speakers, speechwriters, communicators, and event professionals I know about how they're dealing with social media, the obstacles, the opportunities, and a little bit about what the future holds. This episode, I'm going to be talking with Maggie Fox from Social Media Group. She's a social media business pioneer from back in the days when business was pretty skeptical. So she knows a lot about getting tangible, demonstrable results from online efforts. She has an absolutely killer tip that I'm not going to spoil. I'm just going to say it's great for when you're speaking at a large conference, the kind that has multiple tracks. And speaking of large conferences with multiple tracks, just before we begin, wanted to let you know I'm heading to San Francisco next week for NTC, the Nonprofit Technology Conference. It's held every year by a great organization called the Nonprofit Technology Network. I'll be there all week, so three things. First, if you're going to be there too, please let me know. I'd love to see you there and say hi. Second, if you're in the Bay Area or the Valley and you'd like to talk about the social speech, maybe over coffee or something more bracing than coffee, let me know that too. And third, on Tuesday night, that's the first night of NTC, I'm going to be talking about the social speech at Ignite NTC. Now, if you haven't heard of Ignite, it's a presentation style. It's along the lines of Pechachka, which is what I used to pronounce Pechacucha. It's 5 minutes, 20 slides, each one displayed for 15 seconds as this inexorable juggernaut of slides being pushed at the audience while you speak. And by the way, you're speaking without notes. I'll let you know how that goes. And so with all of that said, here's Maggie Fox. We're on with Maggie Fox. Maggie is the leader of Social Media Group. They're one of the biggest leaders in applying social media for real business impact. They have worked with some of the biggest brands around, folks like Ford, and they've really changed the way I think that business looks at social media. Maggie herself is a compelling speaker, really sought after, and we're delighted to have her with us today. How are you doing, Maggie?
Oh, I'm fantastic, Rob, and thank you so much for asking me to participate in your new podcast series. I'm excited.
Well, delighted to have you as one of our first folks. So can you just tell me a little bit about how you approach speaking? How you try to involve people a little more with social media and how it's affected things.
Sure. So, you know, Rob, it often depends on the audience, of course. You know, if it's an event, a social event where you figure that a lot of folks in the audience are going to be familiar with the tools and technology, it's a very different story than if you're, for example, going to speak to an industry group. Because I sort of do these two parallel tracks of speaking. One is, you know, you're asked and hired to speak at industry events, and they tend not always to be very sort of technically savvy necessarily. And then, of course, you go and you speak to with your peers and colleagues and folks in the business at conferences dedicated to social media topics and to practitioners. So I'm going to set aside the kind of industry groups because I think that's a different kettle of fish. But when we're asked, anyone on the SMG team is asked to speak at an industry conference, you know, there's a few things that we'll typically do in order to kind of tee it up and let people know the event is happening and try to build some excitement ahead of time. And we've done this with our own events too, because we've held Social Media Week events and other events in our own space and leveraged these tools and approaches as well. So typically what we'll do, and it's really pretty simple, is, you know, in many cases, email is the killer app. So what we'll often do is do an email blast and say, you know, we're going to be at this conference. We're going to be talking about this particular topic. If you're interested, here's how you can register. And by the way, there'll be a discussion during the talk online, and here's the hashtag that we'll likely be using. In addition, we'll post about it on the blog, right? We'll use Twitter. Let people that know that we're going to be there try to drum up some excitement for the topic, drum up some excitement for other speakers that might be attending or speaking with us, and sort of let people know that we're going to be there. It's an interesting topic. If they can't be there, they can again engage with us before or after on Twitter and also through comments on our blog, which is syndicated across a couple of different channels.
And how are you finding the engagement? Do people join in online? Do you have a lot of chatter, or does it depend on the event?
It totally depends on the event. It depends on the audience, depends on, of course, the size of the event. I would say that generally speaking, for most of the events that we do, the chatter's pretty strong. It's pretty, you know, there can be, you know, 30, 40, 50, even hundreds of tweets, depending on the nature of the conversation. I'm thinking in particular, and this is very specific, but you can see why it was a big conversation. A couple of years ago, Scott Monty, who's the head of social media at Ford, and I did a co-presentation around a case study of work that we had done with Ford at Web 2.0 Expo in San Francisco. And what we decided to do was to set up our own hashtag for that particular session. We let everyone know right off the top of the presentation. And then the way they had it set up, which I think is not always the best practice, was to have screens on either side of the stage that had the Twitter stream. So that hashtag in particular was pulled up in our Twitter stream. And we had, at the time, about 15 pages, and this is the old Twitter search functionality, but about 15 pages of tweets.
Wow.
So it was huge. Like the conversation, the incredibly engaged audience, very large audience, probably 200 or 300, actually it was probably about 400 people, you know, really engaged. We set it up with our own hashtags so that it was really easy to segment out that very specific piece of conversation, which I think is you asked me to save a tip for later, and unfortunately I've given my tip away now. And that is that if you can, you know, conference organizers will typically set up a hashtag for the overall event. In my experience, having a hashtag for the very specific segment is actually better, because mm-hmm. then folks know, you know, then you have a true back channel in your room, as opposed to a very noisy overall conversation that might reflect a much broader series of topics.
Well, and especially if yours is one of several concurrent events, if it's a panel, say at a conference or something, I can imagine that you'd want to be able to narrow it that way.
Exactly. You could have three other sessions going on, and the conversation for all of those things is all jumbled together. Yeah.
One of the things that I've noticed at a few conferences now is that from time to time, people will be saying, this session, not so interesting. I'm bailing on this because the online conversation seems to be so much more interesting for this other session.
That's right.
And the back channel acts kind of as a promotion.
It does. The back channel can be a promoter or a, what's the opposite of a promoter? A depromoter.
Yeah.
absolutely. That. And I've done that myself. You sort of make this judgment call when you look at the noise, right? You look at the volume, you look at the engagement of the conversation. And I do a weekly webinar series with Social Media Today, the website. We do it every Tuesday at noon Eastern. And it's fascinating for me because I also watch the Twitter stream while I'm moderating these panel discussions with these very bright people who often join us. And I can tell in an instant whether or not it is a topic that's really working for the audience. I mean, you just see it in the volume, you see it in the engagement, you see it in the comments. So one of the challenges, though, when you're on stage is to pay attention to that back channel and say the things you're supposed to say and be thoughtful and responsive. I mean, that's just way too much to do, right? It's just way too much to do. So you pretty much, I think when you're on stage, you're at the mercy of it and you can't really necessarily react to it because most people just can't function on those two levels. And of course, we've seen situations where it's gone horribly wrong to have a very active back channel, you know, visible to the larger audience in the case of Dana Boyd a couple of years ago at Web 2.0 Expo again, but this time in New York City. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that sort of, it was a bit of a mob situation that happened.
It was, and there have been a few similar ones. I think there was one at Le Web.
Was it? Right.
Le Web,
yep.
And again, just mob mentality got in, and all of a sudden, you know, it's projected behind them. They don't know exactly what's going on. So how do you handle that? Or is it a question of recruiting somebody to work with you and perhaps taking pauses and give you feedback?
It's a great question because it would be wonderful, wouldn't it? It would be wonderful to be able to say, oh, you know, I see from your comments that you're feeling X, Y, or Z, right? That you're, I'm talking too fast. Sorry. Whatever the case may be. But at the same time, I find it so difficult. Personally, I would find it extremely difficult to do that and remain present in what I'm trying to do, which is communicate with the audience, read the audience, look at them. And I just personally think the idea of having a Twitter stream behind someone's back where they can't see it is just a recipe for disaster. And the Dana Boyd incident in particular, I was there in the audience.
Oh, really?
When that was happening. And it was ugly. It was that was a poor use of technology, and a bunch of poor behavior from people who were just being jerks, frankly. You know, it was very unkind and very schoolyard. And I think just because it's social technology doesn't mean you get to do whatever you want. You still have to not be a jerk. And I sort of look at that and think that's just kind of asking for trouble in a way, because people, you know, I think tend to behave in ways they wouldn't normally behave if they had to come out and be themselves in front of other people. It was a bit of bullying for sure.
Well, talk about making lemonade from lemons, because Dana Boyd then posted this remarkably honest, I thought tremendously courageous post about how she felt she hadn't done that well objectively, but also what the experience of the back channel was like.
Yes.
And I think it changed the way a lot of people looked both at how you handle the back channel, whether you project it, whether you distract from the speaker and the narrative that they're conveying, but also how you behave in a back channel and, you know, how it can become anti-social media in a way.
Yes. Yeah. Her post was excellent. Yeah. Yeah. I agree completely. And, you know, she was a human being about it, right? It was a vulnerable discussion where she said, and when I posted about it as well. And I mean, can you imagine being in her shoes? Can you imagine how that must have felt, that you know something's gone horribly wrong and you have no idea what? You know, what a horrible place to be. And yeah, I think by being human and vulnerable and saying, look, this was really uncomfortable and unpleasant, and being honest about it, she, you're right. She completely changed the tone of the discussion, and I think raised a valid point, which is, again, you know, mean people suck.
Well, it's also a reflection on the way we constantly talk about how social media is disruptive and that organizations that are doing communicating have to change and adapt. But it's also us as individuals and participants who have to, you know, learn about our behavior and what kind of an impact it has. So it's educational for audiences, I guess, as well as for speakers.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that people sometimes hide behind the fact that, well, it's don't try to silence me. Don't you try to be old school and say that my use of new technology is inappropriate. Don't try to hold, you know, don't be the man. But the reality is that doesn't mean you get to do whatever you want and be a jerk, right? You still have to be a human being. You still have to be decent. And just because it's social media and it's a crowd, sometimes it turns into a mob, and that's not okay.
So what are some examples of the more productive participation that you've seen? And are there ways to elicit that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I enjoy taking questions from Twitter. I think that is a wonderful way of extending the conversation well beyond the participants in the room. So again, when you pre-promote and let people know that at a certain time using a certain hashtag, there's going to be a discussion online about a particular topic, you are then able to invite people who of course would not be able to fly to that place or pay for the conference fee in order to be able to participate. And you see sort of two different streams of content that people will typically generate. One is quoting, right? You know, they're sort of repeating the salient points, kind of pressing it and providing nuggets of what they think is valuable. And then you'll see people having discussion. So it's mm-hmm. it's building on the content that you've created and adding their own take or questioning it or you know, echoing it or, you know, whatever their feedback might be. So I like the idea, and I think a lot of organizations like SAP and others have done a great job at understanding that it's the people who are there physically are the hub, but that there is a larger ecosystem of people who may not be able to be there who are interested, and providing channels and ways for those people to engage is really great. And of course, Twitter is the quintessential way of doing that.
Because of its real-time characteristics?
Yep, it's accessibility. You don't need any, you know, relative accessibility. I mean, I'm not logging into a webinar. I can do it mobile. You know, and again, yes, as you've said, that real-time time nature and the ability to sort, just the way that Twitter lets you sort stuff. You can sort of filter down just to that conversation if the hashtag's used consistently and engage even though you're not there. And ask questions of the person in the room. I mean, sort of one of the best, like when we do the webinars for social media today, I'll take questions from Twitter in real time. It's hard, as I said, it's hard to do that on stage, but if you have someone working with you who, you know, with the microphone who says, you know, there's a question, and I've been in situations like this where they'll say there's a question on Twitter and the question is, and they'll repeat it into the mic so everybody can hear it. I think that's a great way of just extending the footprint of the event and the content.
Now, we've talked a little bit about using Twitter and other tools to raise awareness and excitement about an event beforehand. Do you ever do it to engage the audience that's going to be there or going to be monitoring and try and either have them crowdsource material or discuss issues beforehand?
I have not myself done that in a very long time. just mostly because I just don't have it together enough to always be able to do that. But that is a wonderful use, especially, you know, depending on your topic as well. I mean, if you have a topic that's a little more open-ended, or you're planning to do a presentation that's a little more free-form, less formal, and you really, really need to count on audience participation, that is a great way of engaging people. And I think, you know, you see a lot of that, particularly at South by Southwest, because there's so many innovative ways of presenting that people are leveraging. That, you know, the idea of sort of getting the community of people you're hoping are going to attend to start the discussion ahead of time just gets you that much farther down the road when you're actually in the room together.
And afterwards, how do you handle the, do you do anything to archive the conversation that's happened, or do you engage folks afterwards as well, maybe connect with the people who are there?
So I think one of the best ways to continue the conversation after, or at least retain some level of touch point with people, not everyone, but those who are interested, is actually, if you can, to put your slideshow on something like SlideShare. So what I've done in the past, which has been very effective, is to, at the end of the presentation, have the URL for the SlideShare location. You know, if you're interested in the slide deck, the slides are up here. And just right in the room at the time when everyone is present and totally focused on you, to let them know where they can get that content and another channel through which they can connect with you. So I think that, and I have seen that to be very effective in the past, you know, that you'll see, well, in the case of, specifically in the case of the Ford Motor Company case study that we did at Web 2.0, SlideShare actually ended up featuring it on the homepage, and I think we got, you know, three or 4,000 downloads. SlideShare was smaller then, but 3,000 or 4,000 downloads that day. So that's something that can be really effective, where you can just allow people to connect with the content and take it and mash it up and do what they need to do with it in a business context. Just take it away. Take it and go do what you want with it. It can be very effective. I've participated in Twitter chats and other things where they do archive the entire conversation. I have to confess, from my perspective, I've looked at those archives and thought, this is a big jumbled mess that I cannot really comprehend. I question, maybe it's just the tools that are available to do that now aren't so great. Like, they don't show the nested conversations. It's just a stream, because it's totally disjointed. And you sort of think, I'd have to read through this whole thing and memorize everything to piece this together. I haven't found them to be terribly valuable.
One of the things that I've liked is seeing people storify the conversations that have happened afterwards. And they're able to do a little bit of a thread. Here are three selected tweets, for example, about this particular question.
Yep. Yeah. And I think users need that level of, they need that level of threading and storytelling, because otherwise it's just noise, right? It's just push. And so I think, if you're going to do that afterwards, you owe some level of narrative to the people who may come across that content later.
And do you find that there are relationships that come out of this via social channels?
Well, absolutely, because, I mean, the beautiful thing about speaking at an event about something that resonates with people is that they often choose to connect with you later. They figure, you know, it's the content attracts, right? If I have some great content in one context, many people will say, I bet you have other great content too, and may choose to follow you on Twitter or Facebook or subscribe to your blog or whatever channels you have, you know, on LinkedIn even to a certain extent, although I find that LinkedIn for me doesn't really work from a community perspective. It's more of an archive, right? It's a file folder as opposed to an engagement platform.
Yeah, a lot of folks find it kind of like a content-rich CRM more than Facebook for professionals.
Exactly right. You know what? That's a great way of putting it. It's like a very robust address book, right? Yeah, and not to say that it doesn't have value, because it has a ton of value, and I'm in LinkedIn every single day, but it's just not quite, it's not conversational, just as you've said, not a conversational platform. So anyway, that idea of growing and building channel through speaking at events has absolutely been, I have found that to be true, absolutely, that I'll speak at an event, and depending on the size of the event, I may walk away with, you know, 10 or 100 new people following me on Twitter, which is nice, and I'm sure not all of them stay, because sometimes I tweet about my lunch, but, you know, that the ability to continue that relationship with them and hopefully produce content that will add value for them has been a benefit to us in our business in terms of having a fairly robust channel to communicate things that are important to us and our business. So,
well, let's talk a little bit about the business impact, and maybe also if you have a sense of the change that you're trying to effect. I've noticed that most speeches most of the best speeches that people give, there is some call to action that folks have beyond just, you know, hire us for your next engagement. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing tangible or measurable impact on either of those dimensions?
Sure. So I'm a firm believer that I'm about service and not sales. So mm-hmm. when we go out to speak, and my entire management team speaks often, so it's certainly not just me, and I'd like it to be less and less me, frankly, and more them, because I am but one person and they are a whole bunch of brilliant, awesome people. So when I go out and talk, I go out and talk to share the work that we've done, because I believe there are insights, and some of the insights we have to hold tight because they're competitive advantage, but there are lots of things that we can share, interesting things that we have found that are sort of the perfect silver bullet, if you will, because they're really engaging content. You know, literally, what really gets me going is when I'm able to share something with a group of people and have them go, whoa, I did not know that. That makes my day. I love doing that. And I love doing it when it's based on the work that my team has done, because it makes me so proud. So my goal is to walk into a room and share things with people that make them say, wow, I had no idea that happened. Because at the same time, when they do that and they feel that way, they think to themselves, of course, this is an organization that really knows their stuff. You know, they're able to not only execute things that deliver these insights, but take the insights, understand what they mean, and communicate that to me in a way that's very actionable. So that's my goal. When I stand on stage, what I want to do is share the work that we've done in a way that adds value and lets people go off and do interesting things and think about things differently. You'll notice that none of that is about sales. The call to action is not, and then come and hire us. Because I figure if you have a need, you are not stupid. You will figure that we will probably, you know, that someone like us or someone like us could probably help you. So for us, that's the approach. It's really about adding value through high quality content. Figuring that if you do good work, good things will happen to you. Now, when it comes to a call to action itself, I mean, usually our call to action is, you know, if you'd like to download this, or if, you know, you'd like additional information, you can go here. You know, we won't typically have the call to action be about anything other than adding additional value, right? If there's something more that you like, or you'd like a deeper relationship, if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, if you'd like to subscribe to an email newsletter once you hit our website, that sort of stuff is always quite secondary. And mm-hmm. I've never sort of really thought about it, Rob, to be honest. I mean, maybe it should be less secondary, but it feels like if you need help, you know where to find us, you know?
I'm thinking the call to action more like, you know, as you're conducting your next initiative on social media, you know, try to start measuring along this dimension, and you'll find impact. Or as you're marketing to people, be more authentic and personal, and or
right.
try a blog post where you're a little more transparent.
Yes.
And vulnerable.
I understand. So the idea that you give sort of very actionable insights
exactly
to someone as part of the content, critical, mission critical. I agree. I think that it depends on the type of conference, and it depends on the type of circumstance, because I've been lucky enough to be asked to participate for a couple of years now in a conference called DFRAG, which is really about big thinking, big ideas. Mm-hmm. You don't have to talk about things that are real yet. You can get on stage and do a keynote and say, this is something that popped into my head at 2 a.m. and I think in 5 years, this is going to really matter. You know, you're allowed to get on stage, and that's what it's supposed to be about. And so that's a very different, it's hard to be actionable when it's all in your, it's an idea in your head you're articulating for the first time to 500 people, right? But that's different. That's not the majority. The majority of conferences, people want to be able to take something away that they can do something with. And I think when you look at the messaging and construction of the deck, when we talk about that level of sort of deconstructing the deck itself, right, the content that you're actually delivering, I mean, there are story arcs and different structures that you need to take into account. But one of the key takeaways, if you want to think about what kind of content people are going to share around the event during it on Twitter, for example, in the back channel, mm-hmm. it's really important to deliver them nice little bite-sized chunks. So I typically try to have, depending on the length of the presentation, 6 to 10 little bon mot, right? Like little concise phrases. For example, the 3 B's, you know, are build, borrow, and buy when you think about content. Really nice little concise, discrete chunks of information that are bite-sized and perfectly sized for Twitter. That is the kind of content that really carries and goes far. And you'll often see people who are not there start to pick up because it resonates with them. So I think when you think about, you know, how to actually construct content that people choose to share, because of course that's the other part of the conversation, never mind these channels and tools. You have to actually talk about something people find interesting, that sort of structure and construction in your content is really key to success. And you'll see people who are really good at it. It's the one-liner, right? It's the quotable quote that every PR trained spokesperson on TV knows like the back of their hand. You'll see them deliver these wonderful little bite-sized pieces of content. And as a speaker on stage, you need to be thinking that way as well.
And just happens to fit in a tweet.
Yeah, 120 characters or less if you want to have room for retweets. Yeah, exactly.
One last question. Are there times when you think that social tools wouldn't be appropriate for a presentation where you want to keep it contained within the room and within the time of the conversation?
It's a good question. I guess it depends on your objectives. I mean, I think, you know, the idea of the back channel behind the speaker where the speaker can't see it, I am firmly of the mind that's a stupid idea. Like, yeah, that's not a good use because it's just distracting and just leaves room for cowards to behave stupidly. I guess it depends on, I mean, if it's a very exclusive event, it's sort of something you don't want, you know, if you want to get the content, you have to be here kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I could see you choosing to do that. At the same time, I am not entirely sure that it would be possible. You know, how do you stop people from tweeting during a conference? Take away their phones and things like that. So I think that horse might be out of the barn.
Fair enough. Although a lot of convention facilities I've been to seem to manage it by having really lousy Wi-Fi and being six stories underground, so you can't get mobile connection.
Too true, too true.
Can I ask you, is there one tool that you don't think has had its time in the sun yet that folks should know about and maybe try?
This is a tough question. I wish I had more time to play with tools than I do, because I really am a geek at heart and I do enjoy messing around with new pieces of technology. Okay, I'll tell you one. I've got one, and it's really simple and it's not very sexy, but it really makes my life easier. And that is, when you're trying to schedule a conference call with 10 really busy people, there's a tool called Doodle, and I believe it's doodle.com. And it allows you, yes, it is doodle.com. It allows you to say, here are the availabilities, pump out an email to everyone, and tell them to check the boxes that they are available during. And it saves so much email. You have no idea.
Yeah, it is a fantastic. Back and forth. Yeah, no, Thursday's not good for me anymore.
Isn't that painful? And Doodle, one email to everybody. Everyone takes a couple seconds to go in, note when they're available, and then it will tell the organizer, this is the one time slot that everyone has time, and then you book it and you're done.
And one tip that you'd share with folks. We talked a little bit about hashtags.
I'm going to reshare that tip because it's a good one, I think. And that is, when you're speaking at a large conference and there are multiple tracks, even if there aren't, if you would like your content to stand out from the stream and be more easily sortable, set up your own nice and short hashtag that's a modification on the conference tag, but specific to your own session.
Maggie, thank you very much.
You are very welcome, Rob. Thank you.
I was speaking with Maggie Fox of Social Media Group in Toronto. You can find her as Maggie Fox on Twitter and at socialmediagroup.com. We'll be back next episode with a conversation with David Eves. Dave's a friend of mine from here in Vancouver. He's also one of the leading voices around open government and open data. He's just a mind-boggling, provocative speaker. He's a superb writer as well. Here's a taste.
My blog kind of allows me to go and take a look and find stories that might be great metaphors or parallels to the topic. And then I have a story that I actually already know intimately well because I've written about it and I've thought about it. And then I can weave that into my talk. You know, I'm not just pulling it randomly from some article. It's something that I can actually really weave in a really powerful way because I'm intimately familiar with it.
That's in episode 4 of the Social Speech Podcast next week. Now, over to you. If you know a great tool or tip for using social networks and shared media in public speaking, if you have a cautionary tale, a hashtag horror story, or a back channel burnout, or if you have some thoughts about where all of this is headed, let me know. You can share it with me on the show notes. Just visit socialsignal.com/social-speech and look for the podcast link. Or you can email me, rob@socialsignal.com. And of course, next week, if you're in San Francisco, you can look me up there. The music for this podcast is Cold Cloth and an Ice Pack by Derek Miller. We miss him. You can find this song and many others under a Creative Commons license, talk about social, at penmachine.com. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.